The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 8th of April 2021 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's programme.
I certainly think in a particular area of Northern Ireland that there are malign and criminal elements who are whipping up some of our young people.
DUP leader Arlene Foster clearly entirely baffled as to who they might be. We'll speak to former Northern Ireland Secretary of State Peter Hain about the escalating violence. Also ahead, we'll assess US President Joe Biden's chances of steering his colossal infrastructure bill through a delicately balanced Senate. We'll bring you the latest business news, and it's Thursday, so Fernando Augusto Pacheco is right here for the Global Countdown.
Labą dieną, Andrew. Today we're looking at the best things Lithuanian pop can offer.
Improvise witty response to Fernando. I've read that out loud again, haven't I? That's all coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. And welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. Last night, for the sixth consecutive night, Northern Ireland witnessed scenes of the kind of violence likely to prompt considerable agitation in observers with long enough memories. More than 55 police officers are known to have been injured in the last week and considerable damage done to buildings and vehicles. The worst of the most recent disturbances occurred around one of the so-called peace walls, which separate nationalist and loyalist communities in West Belfast. The Northern Ireland Assembly has been recalled for an emergency session at Stormont today. I'm joined with more on this by Lord Peter Hain, former Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. Lord Hain, as you would know better than most people, the Good Friday Agreement did not end sectarian tension in Northern Ireland. There has been sporadic tension and violence over the decades since. But measured against that scale, how bad is what we're seeing now?
Well, it's nothing like, as you indicate, the level of bombing and assassination and horror that the 30 years or so of troubles brought to Northern Ireland with all the terrorism. But it is serious, and it needs to be addressed not just by Northern Ireland's leaders, who are displaying, frankly, a lack of leadership, which is really disturbing, but also by Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, who've been pretty absent from the scene in Northern Ireland now for quite a while, and especially over this.
What's your read of what's behind this? Because there is always the trap of reading significance which might not exist into what might just be a bunch of bored young men looking for trouble.
No, there are elements of that, and there are a variety of other factors. But the main problem has arisen over frustration amongst the unionist community, the Protestant community, over the fact that there are checks and controls in for businesses doing trade with Great Britain, with England, Scotland, or Wales, across the Irish Sea. Northern Ireland, of course, is on an island with the Republic of Ireland to the south, and is also within the United Kingdom. And within the United Kingdom, the rest of the United Kingdom, there are no barriers to trade of any kind between Scotland and England, or between Wales and England, or for that matter, Scotland and Wales. But there are now, as a result of Brexit, across the Irish Sea between England, Scotland and Wales to Northern Ireland for the first time. And that has arisen because the type of Brexit that Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, pursued, which was to break any real alignment with the European trade and customs arrangements and to go for an entirely separate Great Britain. But in order to make sure that the Good Friday peace process and the stability which it has brought since 1998 was maintained, the Irish border had to be kept open. That's to say, the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland to its south, as it has been now for decades and has become invisible with all sorts of human activity crossing it. And therefore, it's not had the toxic role, played a toxic role because it's been invisible that it did in generations gone by. And that's all to the good. If, however, that had become the external frontier, customs frontier of the European Union, then it could have ignited all those old problems that had so beset and bedeviled Northern Ireland. So instead, what Boris Johnson agreed to was to keep the border open. That meant that Northern Ireland remained in the European Union's customs union and its trading market, but that inevitably, because the United Kingdom was leaving, Great Britain would be outside those arrangements, so there had to be checks across the Irish Sea between Northern Ireland and Great Britain. Of course, the Prime Minister denied this in his normal airy way at the beginning, and Unionists and Loyalists in particular, who some of the most hard-line involved, feel betrayed because he wasn't straight with them.
Where do you see then the causal connection between that dissatisfaction with the post-Brexit arrangements and what we've seen in West Belfast? Is it possible that there are people who are or were associated with loyalist paramilitarism who are leveraging that discontent to cause this trouble?
Yes, there are. And there are also criminals amongst them, who drug traffickers and so on, who've resented a police crackdown, which has been quite effective in their communities to try and get rid of this drug trafficking problem. And but it was ignited not because of that so much, though it's fed into it, but also but primarily because suddenly loyalist Protestant Unionists suddenly found that, contrary to what Boris Johnson had told them, there are actually checks and controls strangling a lot of Northern Ireland businesses in a mountain of red tape. And naturally, they see that as a break within the United Kingdom, because it puts Northern Ireland in a different place from, say, England, Scotland or Wales. So they feel that their fundamental beliefs in the union of the United Kingdom and Northern Ireland being within that is being threatened. And that is what ignited it. There was none of this until that issue suddenly arose around New Year, because the Prime Minister, frankly, as I say, told a lot of porkies on it and didn't level with the Unionist community, and they suddenly found themselves in this predicament, and it created insecurity and understandable anxiety, out of which these other factors, criminality, youth, vandalism and so on, out of which that's fed.
You mentioned earlier an absence of leadership both in Northern Ireland and in the United Kingdom. What would a constructive response from especially Northern Irish politicians at this point look like? Presumably not like the one we saw on Twitter from Arlene Foster, who went, and it is a term with which you will be familiar, full whataboutery, suggesting that the violence will, and I quote, take the focus off the real lawbreakers in Sinn Féin. That's probably not the most helpful intercession she could have made at this point, is it?
Well, I think when you become First Minister, which is effect of Northern Ireland as she is, although it's an unusual arrangement in that she has joint authority with the Deputy First Minister, Michelle O'Neill, who's a Sinn Féin leader, When you reach these positions, you've got to speak for the whole of the community. Prime ministers and presidents naturally have their own party agendas to follow and their own party members to satisfy in any country, in any democratic system. But you're trying to speak for the whole nation and act for the whole nation as well once you assume those positions. And what has been disappointing about both of them, and especially in recent days, Arlene Foster's utterances, is she's not adopted that role. She's effectively acting as a party politician for a Democratic Unionist Party rather than speaking for the whole of the community across Northern Ireland and across the religious and political divides that have bedeviled it for so many generations. And I think that's the kind of leadership we need, and we haven't got it. Equally across the water, London has been virtually silent on Northern Ireland now for really ever since David Cameron and the Conservatives came to power in 2010. And I don't make this point on a party basis as a Labour politician and also who was a Labour Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, because it's traditionally been a non-partisan issue between both the major parties. I make it because I'm genuinely, and I've been hugely critical of the absence of Number 10 Downing Street, of the Prime Minister, in a way that Tony Blair and Gordon Brown were involved, John Major, the Conservative Prime Minister, before them, playing an honest broker role. Effectively, what they've done is said, well, not that, you know, the Good Friday process, the peace settlement that I helped to negotiate in 2007 that brought the old enemies to share power together, that's all done and dusted, and therefore we can concentrate on the other pressures of government. And that was fatal. So we've only seen a couple of sentences from the Prime Minister over the last few days when parts of Belfast have been up in flames, and a couple of tweets from the Northern Ireland Secretary of State. Frankly, that's not good enough. They should be convening all-party talks in person to try and resolve these problems, as the Labour Shadow Secretary of State, Louise Haig, has called for. And they should be on the case all the time instead of effectively, you know, absence without leave, as has been the case over Northern Ireland now, sadly, for a number of years.
Lord Hayne, thank you as always for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing. Here is Monocle's Yolene Goffin with the day's other headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. India's Serum Institute, the world's largest vaccine maker, will resume foreign exports in June as long as cases in the country fall. The company paused orders of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine last month in order to redirect supplies to local facilities. India had its worst day of new infections on Wednesday, with 126,000 cases recorded nationwide. Myanmar's ambassador to the UK spent the night in his car after claiming he was locked out of his embassy. Jarsar Min says the country's military attaché ordered him and other staff to leave the building due to their support for protests against the recent coup. The ambassador has called for pro-democracy leaders such as Aung San Suu Kyi to be released by the junta. A left-wing party has won a general election in Greenland. The Inuit Ataqatigiit Party's victory has cast doubt on plans for a rare earth mine, an issue that dominated campaigning. Greenland Minerals, owners of the proposed site, claim it will provide materials for weapons and electronics. And today's Monocle Minute includes a report on Paris's waste management crisis. The French capital has become the stench capital, as shortfalls in funding have led to overflowing bins and the general air of désintégré. Head to monocle.com/minute for more trash talk. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Yolene. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. Now, whatever other quibbles one may raise about the first 78 days of the US presidency of Joe Biden, he cannot be accused of lacking ambition, as most obviously demonstrated by his $2 trillion plus infrastructure proposal. However, nothing in American politics is likelier to make something easier said than done, or just not done at all, than Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, a formidably effective obstructor, blocker, and Wrecker. So how does President Biden go about getting his big idea onto the books? Well, I'm joined with more on this by Suzanne Lynch, Washington, D.C. correspondent for the Irish Times. Suzanne, we're seeing the early barrages of flak being put up by McConnell and his fellow Senate Republicans. Do they have any principled objections to what Joe Biden is proposing, or is the fact that a Democratic president is proposing it enough?
Well, that is a point, because Joe Biden had felt that infrastructure is something that everyone can get behind, Republicans and Democrats. But what's now happening actually is a debate about what he means by infrastructure. And some of the Republicans, like Mitch McConnell, are saying that infrastructure should just mean traditional roads, bridges, airports, those kind of concrete examples of infrastructure. Whereas, in fact, the Biden definition is also including things like green energy and broadband and less concrete examples of infrastructure. So it's quite an interesting moment here at the moment, because this debate, it's quite an animated debate about what actually an infrastructure plan can include. So to answer your question, I think that is allowing a lot of the Republicans to argue that Joe Biden is in fact too ambitious, that he's trying to push in other issues into what should be a bread and butter infrastructure package. But as you say, you know, he's going to have to get this through Congress. He has only got a very slim majority, particularly in the Senate, so he's going to have a lot of selling to do. Now, what we did hear yesterday was a key part of that plan, and that is his plan to raise taxes to try and finance a lot of this infrastructure spending. So yesterday we heard from Biden and Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, about their quite ambitious plans to mainly increase taxation on corporations.
I mean, a lot of the focus is going to be, of course, on what Joe Biden will need to do to get this past Republicans. But it's not necessarily a lock that he gets it past his own party, which he does have to do, because even if Kamala Harris as vice president gets her casting vote, it's still an evenly split Senate. It's 50-50. And of course, there might be Democratic senators, might there not, who think, well, here's a chance to make a name for myself or raise something for my own district.
Yes, exactly. And he's caught in a bind, in a sense, because some members of his party on the left, people who would have supported the idea of a Green New Deal in the last couple of years, for them, you know, this package is not ambitious enough. They want more in it. You know, somebody like a Bernie Sanders, for example, would be somebody on that who's in the Senate and who votes with Democrats. He would be somebody who wants an expansive package as possible. On the other side, he has got more conservative Democrats like Joe Manchin from West Virginia, a real kind of old energy kind of state of West Virginia, that he will be opposed to excessive spending and to maybe some of the more progressive parts of the package. Example, for example, spending on new green energy projects that might undermine the economy in his own state. So, yes, he is going to have a tricky balance to make sure his entire party is with him on this. They do only need, as you explained there, you know, he's only got it split between Democrats and Republicans. In saying that, one way around this is that he could attract votes from Republicans, maybe a Mitt Romney or Susan Collins, who might be prepared to vote for the infrastructure package. So that's what the White House is going to be doing right now. It's going to be making calls to see if they have the votes, what people want, and what people are asking for in order to fund this. But the price tag is big. And we need to remember that he has just passed the American Rescue Plan, that big COVID relief package. And now he's asking for another $2 trillion. And that's only the first part of it. He's talking about, you know, further plans later in the year that come up to $4 trillion. So a lot of money. And Republicans are going to balk at this price tag, saying, you know, America cannot afford this. So they're the kind of debates around this issue for him.
Suzanne Lynch, thank you, as always, for joining us from Washington, D.C. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. A global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. John Tsai leads the Global Drug Development Organization and is also the Chief Medical Officer at Novartis. John Tsai, you've spoken about improving and extending people's lives. Do all these like-minded people wind up at Novartis, or is there something in Novartis's corporate approach, in its very makeup almost, that fosters that focus on patients, on improving outcomes?
I think it's probably a combination of both, that the individuals that work at Novartis probably have a natural curiosity as well as having a purpose that's aligned to improve patients' lives. As I think about what really drives me and what motivates me and what makes me wake up on a daily basis, I have these four cornerstones that really guide me in my life. Two of those are probably more professionally aligned. Two of those are more personally aligned. And these four cornerstones are: one, having an impact on patient lives; two, to be an inspiring leader. The other two on the personal side is being a loving husband and a supportive father. And the fourth is really giving back to the community. So as I think about those four cornerstones and what guides me, I think the two around improving patients' lives and being an inspiring leader are the ones that really guide me and is fully aligned with Novartis's purpose and mission.
That's John Tsai, who leads the Global Drug Development Organization and is also Chief Medical Officer at Novartis. Just another of the ways in which Novartis is reimagining medicine.
You are back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Muller. It's time now to take a look at the latest business news. I'm joined, as usual, by Ewan Potts at Bloomberg. Ewan, some new analysis on who could be hit by rising prices in the year to come. What are we learning?
And one of the conversations we've been having most frequently with guests on Bloomberg over the course of this year has been about the reemergence of inflation. Now, with growth really picking up in the US, we're expecting 6, even 7% growth this year in America, and robust growth in Europe as well. It's certain that prices will also pick up. How much by? We're not quite certain yet. That is a matter of a lot of debate. The Federal Reserve also being clear that it will allow the US economy to run a little bit hotter and inflation to creep up a little bit higher than we might otherwise expect. It's doing that in part because it hopes to keep a strong jobs market going. That will, of course, benefit lower paid Americans. But an interesting bit of research today from Bloomberg Economics about who will be hit in America by rising prices. It says that some of the biggest price hikes in recent months have come from gasoline. A gallon of petrol up 75 cents since late last year. It doesn't sound much to a European, but that's a lot if you're filling up a big American car. And food price inflation also running at more than double the headline rate, with staples like household cleaning products also rising in price. The analysis suggests that those things will hit low-income people most. That's, of course, because groceries and gasoline take up a bigger share of their monthly shopping basket than is the case for wealthier households. And, of course, rising food prices also a problem for many of the poorest people around the world elsewhere as well. So interesting, a bit of analysis on the rise of inflation.
There is also a goodly deal of interest in a new flotation on the New York Exchange.
Yeah, it's the startup behind the COVID vaccine being developed by University of Oxford and AstraZeneca. Of course, it's been in the news a great deal this week. The FT reports that Vaxitech has confidentially filed for an IPO in the US this week. It's not good news, really, for London's IPO market. Of course, we had the failed Deliveroo share flotation just a couple of weeks ago. We understand that investors are aiming for an IPO valuation of about $700 million. Pretty interesting company. It's part-owned, 10% owned by the University of Oxford. The company has been seeking access so far unsuccessfully to the contract between Oxford and AstraZeneca over the production of the vaccine, which is quite important for the valuation of the company. And some concerns, Dow Jones reports, about nervousness around some of the stumbles on the vaccine rollout and the early negative perceptions about its effectiveness. Interesting also to look more widely at some of these restrictions being put on the AstraZeneca vaccine. It will be of concern to those elsewhere in the world looking to roll out their vaccination programs, because of course the Astra vaccine is one of the cheapest around, the company making it to without any profit during the pandemic, and it's also one of the most stable. It's stable at fridge temperature for up to 6 months, so that will be of concern to those particularly in poorer countries looking to roll out their vaccination programs.
Ewan Potts at Bloomberg, thank you as always. You're listening to The Briefing. And it is last thing on Thursday's briefing. Regular listeners will already know to have dived for cover. But for the rest of you, Fernando Augusto Pacheco is here with the Global Countdown. And, Fernando, for those of us not us, I know where we're going. I remembered what you said at the top of the show. But for those who may have just zoned out since then, where are we going?
I hope you're impressed with my Lithuanian, by the way.
I was very impressed.
Laba diena. I'm even going to say it again.
I don't know if I was or not, because my own Lithuanian, I regret to say, is not what it might be. I can't tell whether you've done a good job of that or not.
It's funny, because I know you are quite a big admirer of the country, right?
I am. This is something we need to, I think, make very, very clear. So any amount of upset I may be about to cause by casting aspersions on their taste in pop music is offset up front by the fact that, yes, I'm a big fan of Lithuania. I have been several times. Vilnius is very possibly my favourite European capital, and honestly, everybody should go as soon as they get the chance.
Well, let's see if your positive impression will continue, Andrew, with number five. I mean, of course, Lithuanians, as many countries in the world, they do enjoy a little bit of hip-hop. This is one of their kind of most famous rappers at the moment.
Is this one of the most famous rappers in Lithuania?
Yes.
Wow.
it's a big thing. It's Seventh Block with Patagu ir Smagu, which means convenient and fun. Patogu ir smagu, kaip aš gyvenu, kas yra nelegalu, tai labiausiai aktualu. Saulė nusileidus man jauku, gatvėse tylu, viešbučio kambarys tamsa, kvepia prabanga, jauki aplinka, kūnas egzotinis į nogą, panės jūra.
Convenient and fun.
Yeah, I mean,
I would say one out of two is not bad.
The song doesn't sound very fun, but what I like about it, it's quite a kind of old school hip hop from the early 90s or something.
He sounds more like he's been inconvenienced, in fact. Do you have any insight into what he is aggrieved about?
To be honest, I read the lyrics. They're not political at all. Basically, it talks about palm trees, cash, pretty girls in a desert island. You know, it's funny because, you know, the song, it sounds so kind of, you know, a bit dark, you know, the beats and everything. But yeah, it's just about fun.
Lithuania, in my experience of it, is a bit light on for palm trees.
Maybe that's what he's missing.
maybe that's it. So that's at number five. Literally one of the biggest rappers in Lithuania.
Exactly.
Okay. At number four.
Number four we have, he's Russian, actually. His name is Khabib Sharipov. It's interesting because he became a big pop star, not only in Lithuania, but in Russia as well. But he's got quite an interesting job. He's a former criminologist. He did work as a criminologist in Kazan, where he is from in Russia. But I mean,
he forswore the life of a criminologist to become a pop star.
Exactly. It was quite a U-turn.
It is. It's not a common trajectory.
And the song is lovely. I think it's very, very catchy. It's called Raspberry by Khabib Sharipov.
I'm just glad he's got the criminology to fall back on.
I've got to be honest, Andrew, I adore it, you know?
You surprise me, Fernando. You know, imagine my astonishment.
There's something about Eastern Europe and their kind of very up-tempo bits that kind of make me feel quite excited.
Okay. I don't really want to explore that any further than we have to. At number three, we have...
Number three is a little bit mid of the road, I have to say. And I was reading a bit more about the artist, Cell. Apparently, they started kind of as a more of a hip-hop and rock band. But they're moving...
Are they also, in fact, part of that burgeoning Lithuanian hip-hop scene we are hearing so much about?
They are indeed. Okay. I mean, it is a scene indeed, Andrew. But now they're moving it to a little bit more of a mellow R&B vibe. And this song is called TikTok. And of course, it talks about social media and our obsession with it. Let's have a listen.
Is the song TikTok literally about the social media video app?
Yes, indeed. And I mean, we can say all the bad things.
That's a ballsy move. I mean, that's like having a song called MySpace in 2004. I mean, this could age badly, is what I'm saying.
But Andrew, if you want to be number one these days, you have to be on TikTok in a way. Not only in Lithuania, but...
Is that where I'm going wrong?
Yes. Okay. I think you should create your own account today. I had to do it for work purposes, huh?
Really?
Yes.
Are you on TikTok, Fernando?
I am on TikTok. Probably I have a hidden profile there. But I am in there indeed.
Okay, I'm almost intrigued. At number two.
Number two, a song I really like. They've been going on since 2014. It's a Lithuanian band. It's kind of...
Part of the burgeoning Lithuanian hip-hop scene we are hearing so much about?
It's hard to describe. It's a mixture of kind of indie rock, a little bit of synths here and there.
Okay.
It's a very cool band. They've been nominated for quite a few MAMA Awards, which is the Lithuanian Grammys, which happened, you know, a few days ago. But they lost. They lost everything they were nominated for. But the song is still pretty good.
They failed to win a Lithuanian Grammy.
Yes.
I have that in common with them.
What a shame. But the song is beautiful. Sisters on Wire with Melina Melina, which means blue, blue. Стрица нас гледа, опен нос наш доле. Лека жура ти клас, крете яке пена нема.
Are they aware that popular music has progressed somewhat since the soundtrack to Top Gun?
Maybe not, but you know, I admire. They're romantics. They say your eyes are like the blue, blue sea. I drown on your on their depth. I think it's beautiful.
I mean, you'd need to be sure of your audience before wheeling that one out. That could go over badly. These things are very much in the eye or indeed ear of the beholder, I'm just saying. At number one,
We were talking about the MAMA Awards, right?
I mean, you were.
Disney's band, you know, they won quite a few MAMA Awards.
Did they
a few
win
weeks
all
ago?
The ones that Sisters on Wire didn't win?
In fact, they did, actually. And they're not only that, they're the Lithuanian Eurovision entry for this year. you can't get better than this, right?
What could possibly go wrong? So this is at number one Lithuania this week. Is it going to win Eurovision, Fernando?
I mean, who knows? I mean, I think they have a chance, yes, because it's a very disco-friendly track, and you know
you
I like that.
Would you even suggest it's worth having a few quid on if you can find decent odds? Would you go so far as to say that?
Go for it. I would go as far as that.
Okay.
Let's have a listen. The Roop, Disco Tack.
Why do I get the feeling there's going to be a mime artist in the performance of it?
Well,
I feel like they're going to go for that moody theatrical vibe, aren't they?
It's very theatrical. There's a lot of sharp choreography involved. No mimes, but almost there, Andrew.
Is there a dance craze?
Of course.
Well, that's something to look forward to. That is number one in Lithuania this week and possibly this year's Eurovision winner, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Thank you, as always. That is all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Rhys James, Alexa Self and Yolene Goffin. Our studio manager was Louis Allen. The Briefing is back tomorrow at midday UK time. I'll be your host for that. I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening.